Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Tillman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And to our great surprise, we're all three together again this weekend. We've all been
so exciting
traveling and parts far and wide. And it turns out we were all available to sit down and have a podcast brunch. So, Lauren, tell us what we are drinking.
We are drinking a leftover from Radha's vacation, a rosé from... What does that even say? La Jara?
Hard to say. It's a special cuvée.
Yeah, it's delicious. It's perfect for brunch if anyone's like, a sparkling rosé, I think, is like the perfect summer drink. So
totally agree.
Yep.
I mean, I've put that to the test in that I feel like I've had a lot of summer drinks over the last week. I was in London and Edinburgh for the last 7 or 8 days. And I will say that they have, you know, like takeaway single serving cans of mixed alcohol in the UK. And I don't really understand why I can't get a whiskey ginger at 7-Eleven here. That's basically...
Well, this is why, you know, they're our big brother, their imperial big brother, and we are just still the Padawan waiting to catch up to free alcohol drinking in the streets.
Well, we'll get into that because they're certainly competing with us for executive branch, or rather just governmental mayhem.
Yeah.
So... we have an excellent guest here with us today to try to make sense of all the craziness. It was always, you know, as always, kind of like hard to follow the news while you're traveling, but it was also kind of like
extra difficult
weird
to escape
to be in a foreign country while foreign country things were happening. So
on the plus side, that foreign country was also being crazy. So
oh, completely crazy. Yeah, we just I had a great conversation with my cab driver yesterday about that, where he was, you know, giving me a little bit of guff about Trump. He actually informed me that Putin was coming to visit, which was news I hadn't heard yet. So so that was great. And then I said that they were having a little trouble getting their act together, and he was like, "Oh yeah, that's truth." So.
Fortunately, we have a guest to help us out to figuring out what is going on, or at least just to, you know, kind of panic commensurately with us. Alina Polyakova is the Rubinstein Fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Foreign Policy. I probably got one of those words wrong in there, but it's fine. Alina is coming to us this week to talk about the post-Helsinki summit world and what does one do as a foreign policy expert or pseudo-expert following up on this, which last week seemed a little bit crazy. But before we get started on that, we're going to start with our usual bombshell questions. Beginning with, Alina, what is your entrance music?
I had to think long and hard about this one, and I'm ashamed a little bit to admit that it's Eye of the Tiger.
It's cool. I say own it.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean,
I'm into
pretty
it.
Much it is the definition of entrance music.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's no reason anybody should not take it if they want it. You're welcome to have it, Alina. It's perfect.
Thank you. Thank you.
What is your most quoted movie line?
So I don't have a good answer for this one, except the one I've used the most personally, and this relates to what we'll be talking about today, which is Russia. Is just as soon as I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Okay, I confess ignorance. What is that from?
Godfather 3.
Godfather. Oh my God, sorry. I'm sorry.
I mean, to be fair, it's a terrible movie.
Yes. Didn't you make your husband watch the Godfather series just recently?
I did because I couldn't stay married to him unless he actually managed to get through
it. Did you watch all
it.
Of them?
We did not because he kept saying, "This is boring, I don't get it."
Oh heavens,
I know.
That's almost like the worst. Like,
I know, it was better to just like stop and like not have the conversation any further with him.
Yeah.
Alina, what is a book that you hate that everyone else loves?
So this is controversial, but I hate Philip Roth's The Human Stain.
Oh, I'm with you there. Anything Philip Roth writes, I'm sorry. I tried so hard because everyone else loves him so much. And it's...
By everyone else, do you mean dudes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've never been able to get more than about 1/10 of the way into any
Philip Roth.
Do
you like other Philip Roth, Alina? Or just that one?
I will say I got a lot of flack for this, mostly from dudes on the Twitter after Philip Roth passed away. And I said that was the only and first book I read by him, and I hated it and couldn't really bring myself to read anything else. So I did force myself just on vacation last week or 2 weeks ago to read American Pastoral by Roth. And that was actually quite good, if painful, read.
I don't
Sounds
think
like they, perfect vacation reading.
Vacation should not be for forced reading. I don't know. I object a little bit on it. But good for you. You've now put your Twitter haters to shame. And what is life if not putting Twitter haters to shame?
Right. So the satisfaction.
Alina, what is your favorite bar in the world?
My favorite bar right now is actually here in D.C. And it's actually the bar at the Iron Gate Restaurant. They have my favorite cocktail in the world, I think. That's no longer on their menu, but they'll still make it for you if you ask, called the Nikolaki. And it's a yogurt cocktail, which sounds weird, but it's delicious.
Yeah. Quizzical looks, but I'm willing to test out basically any drink that someone recommends.
And for our listeners, the Iron Gate is an amazing, I would say, second date location or maybe parent visit location.
It's a good parent visit, especially for kind of a brunch sort of setup.
Yep.
The menu situation, menu can be a little overwhelming because there's some prefix and there's some that's open. But it's a good like statement dinner, whatever it is you're doing. It's a big,
yes,
it's a
you're
big
making
swing.
An impression. They have the oldest wisteria plants in the DC area. So they claim it's probably a lie, but it's huge and it covers the entire back porch and it's delightful.
Excellent bar choice. We are impressed. Okay, Radha, you're up.
Last question. What is the best use of data or statistics you've ever seen?
I think for me, this was the hardest one because I've been so overwhelmed with data for most of my life. I still think the most simplest, and I can't say it was quite clever, but explained a lot about U.S. history and the economy, is the data on inequality, income inequality in the United States, basically graphed along business cycles. And of course, now we're seeing a moment in U.S. history when income inequality is once again at the same level as it was right before the Great Depression, which I think doesn't bode well for our future here in the United States, economically speaking. But I still think just looking at that longitudinal data for the last 100 or so years is quite telling.
I'm into that.
Sorry, we were all chewing on the treats that Aaron brought.
Aaron brought these delicious shortbread that are Earl Grey flavor, and it's hard to not eat them continually.
Yeah.
But I think, actually, I was just reading a series of tweets on the economic conditions in the U.S. and sort of plotting them over time. It's actually plotting them over time and plotting them with business cycles and political cycles, and actually pretty interesting and doesn't really look that great for America and for midterm elections, which I will talk about a little bit when we talk about trade.
All right. Shifting gears from the delightful to the concerning to...
Not the sublime.
Baffling.
Not the sublime. The baffling.
The anti-sublime.
help us figure out what just happened, Alina. I'll let Lauren kick this off.
Yeah. I think that one of the problems with the coverage of President Trump overall is we tend to focus on, you know, very specific things that he says that we can react to with horror and shame and embarrassment in some ways, and less on any substance, really any substance whatsoever, unless it doesn't quite fit with that narrative. And one of the things I'm most curious about on the Helsinki summit, like we obviously don't know exactly what was discussed between President Trump and Putin in their one-on-one meeting, or even in their larger bilateral meeting.
Which, can I just say, I still literally cannot believe. I mean, I can't. Can you imagine any other American president having a two-hour, like, snuggle fest with just, like, no public commentary or release statement?
Not really.
Yeah.
But, you know, we are where we are. So I guess my question is, did Putin get what he was hoping for, or anything in particular out of this summit? Because we focused far more on like the embarrassment as against Trump, but we haven't focused on as nearly as much on what did Russia get out of this, or what did Putin in particular get out of this?
Well, that's right. I think what's been interesting to observe in the aftermath of the summit this past week is how the Russians have basically now been running circles around the White House by setting the agenda. So as the White House has remained completely silent on what went on in Helsinki, what the outcomes were, if there were any, from most of us that just had access to the press conference, it didn't seem like there was any agreement reached or there were any deliverables or outcomes. However, the Russian side, within hours after the summit ended, the Russian MFA and then followed by other Russian government agencies started tweeting these very ambiguous tweets saying, we look forward to implementing the agreements the presidents agreed at Helsinki, and no clarity on what the agreements were. And then very quickly, they started to put out demands. One demand, of course, was that the U.S. hand over U.S. citizens, including the former former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Mike McFaul, but also many others, for quote-unquote questioning without any real reason for that. They have also floated the idea of a U.S.-supported referendum for the Donbas. This is the region in Ukraine's east, where the Russians have been deeply involved in a war now over 4 years.
And that's separate from the Crimea, is that right?
Correct. So Russia continues to occupy Crimea. We haven't seen any movement on that issue. But Russian forces are also very active in Ukraine's east and the Donbas, where we have a hot conflict still, where over, I think, almost 11,000 Ukrainians have died since 2014 there. And they have wanted to have a quote-unquote referendum, similar to the referendum they had in Crimea, for those regions, so they can be declared basically autonomous zones rather than part of Ukraine where the Russian forces have intervened. So to go back to your question, though, like, what did the Russians actually get out of this? So one, they got this, right? They got this ability to set the agenda, as the White House has done nothing and said nothing. On the other hand, obviously, Putin at the summit got his optics, right? He got to look as if he was, and specifically him, on equal standing with the U.S. president, and basically ran circles around the U.S. president, at one point even having to explain U.S. policy for the U.S. president to the reporters who were in the room, which to me was quite a jarring moment to see. So in terms of optics, Putin won hands down.
And so, I mean, that we're talking a little bit about the summit specifically here, but we've also had a sort of churn of White House responses, sort of an uncharacteristic walk back by the Trump administration and by Trump himself on what he said. And I'm just wondering how that sort of aftermath of the summit also plays into this broader Russian narrative about Trump and the deep state and the role that America can and could play with Russia versus what is happening now.
Yeah, so the walk back, that wasn't really a walk back.
Right.
You know, there were all these Twitter memes going around. You know, what if other presidents had made that same mistake? You know, Mr. Gorbachev, don't bring down this wall, was probably my favorite. So it wasn't really real. I think the way that was seen in Russia was, well, Trump said what he really felt at the summit. And then he got home and got all this criticism and had to walk it back, but he didn't want to.
I mean, I think, and that's frankly, pretty fair.
That seems to be the correct interpretation, from what I can tell.
But I think more broadly, there's this sort of weird dynamic at play in which the Russian narrative of the U.S. president is more consistent with the U.S. president's behavior than the U.S. administration's narrative about its own president's behavior. And that obviously creates a lot of complications and trust issues both with Russia and sort of in signaling to our allies in the region that we're not going to totally screw them over.
Well, what's really bizarre for me as somebody who's been following Russia for some time and U.S.-Russia relations to see now is this, I don't even know how to make sense of the current situation, because we see the Russian president now allying himself with the U.S. president against the U.S. government. So if you hear how Putin himself and also the Kremlin state-funded media and other Kremlin officials have talked about the entire Russia investigation, for example, and what happened in Helsinki, they're actually using the exact same words that President Trump has used, calling the special counsel a witch hunt, calling the whole thing, you know, Russophobia and sort of crazy behavior, and then criticizing the so-called deep state and the U.S. intelligence agencies in a very similar way that the U.S. president has been doing. And to my mind, this is absolutely unprecedented and even difficult to make sense of.
So one thing I'm curious about that we talked a little bit about before we got started is, I mean, we all experienced how this played out in the United States and Washington in particular. How did the summit play out in Russian press and in the Russian population?
Well, it was interesting to watch because going into the summit, Putin's popularity ratings have started to slip quite significantly. So just provide a little bit of context. Putin goes into the summit on the heels of the successful World Cup that, you know, really puts sort of some shine on Russia on the international stage. Of course, Trump congratulates Putin on that. And so he's really riding a high. We know that Putin loves these international events, and they're really important to him in terms of optics. So he goes into the summit on a high, yet at the same time, his government has finally had to impose very unpopular economic reforms. One such reform that's gotten a lot of criticism is the raising of the pension age. And as a result, now Putin's popularity rankings are essentially back to his pre-Crimea days.
Oh, really?
Indeed. So they're at least a four-year low now. And Crimea, which gave him his very high boost up to 85%, 86%, that has pretty much worn off as a result of these economic reforms. So he goes into the summit understanding that he needs to bring home a big win to show off that he's still the leader for the Russian people. And he certainly got that. Certainly the Russian media covered the summit as, you know, Putin has made Russia great again. Russia is a global player. Russia is a success, and it's all thanks to Putin. It was obvious that he ran circles around the U.S. president. He had the U.S. president basically confirm and acknowledge the Russian view of the world.
And the Russian view of the U.S. relationship, right? I mean,
that's correct.
Putin and
that's
Trump correct. Both agree it's all Barack Obama's fault, it appears, right?
Well, not even that, but that basically the reason why we're at such a low point in the U.S.-Russia relationship is because of the United States.
Right.
When, of course, that's a complete lie. Russia has been the aggressor in many ways and has ruined the relationship despite multiple attempts that are reset by multiple administrations. So that's exactly how it was interpreted. I think what's interesting, if I can just add a little bit of caveat to that, despite all the fanfare around Putin being amazing and great, there's also a sense that he also overreached a bit.
How so?
That he let his ego really shine. You can really tell from the press conference that Putin was just reveling. I mean, this was the summit that he had waited for his entire time in office. So I think for him, though, this was the only time that the U.S. president acknowledged the Russian view of the world and basically said, we're to blame. And de facto apologized without saying that much to the Kremlin. And so I think for Russian officials, you know, there's been a desire for some time now to return to business as usual, to have a normalization in the relationship, to restore diplomatic relations, military to military relations. And I think the Russian establishment thought this was going to be the outcome of the summit. And what they saw was actually Putin, because probably driven by his own ego, his own desire to look like the big man on the world stage, maybe pushed a little too far, which of course then opened Trump to all the criticism that he's gotten at home.
Interesting. I want to get us out of here on just one last question, which is a little bit more, I don't know, tactical, I guess. But one of the things that I thought would come out of the summit, and because we don't have a readout of the private meeting, and I guess it still could, is discussion around Syria and kind of what both countries are trying to do in Syria. What I was certainly concerned that there would be concessions made to the Russian position in Syria with regard to Assad and other pieces. Do you have a sense of kind of what might still shake out? Do we think that it came up at all? And where does, whatever this reset is, where does that leave us with regard to Syria in general?
That's a great question. In the lead up to the summit, you know, my prediction, as I think a lot of people suspected, that if there was some sort of deal that came out of the summit, it was going to be on Syria. Putin had met with Benjamin Netanyahu, mm-hmm. the prime minister of Israel. He met with top advisors to the Iranian supreme leader in Moscow in just the 2 days right before Helsinki. So that was signaling that there was some deal being negotiated between the Middle East powers and Russia. We got some outlines of that deal, but nothing seems to have come to fruition. So I think it's impossible to tell if we're going to get any movement. Clearly, to my mind, if Putin did not offer that to Trump, it seems like he didn't think he needed to.
In what way? Sorry, if he didn't offer, what would he have offered?
I mean, he could have offered what was floated in the press, in the Russian press, that, and also the U.S. press, was that Putin was negotiating a deal that would move Iranian-backed militias away from the Israeli border,
right.
And then would insert this sort of line of Syrian forces between the Iranians and the Israeli border, and kind of establish a, I think, an 80-kilometer no war zone or no fight zone or no man's land. We didn't see this kind of deal emerge in Helsinki. I think it wouldn't have been a real deal in the sense that Russia has no ability to enforce such a deal, meaning to put troops on the ground and actually monitor that both sides are abiding by the 80-kilometer, whatever they decide, they would have decided, line, that the Iranian forces are not crossing over past the Syrian forces, et cetera. It's a really messy, messy idea. And so I think Putin has no desire, Russia has no desire to actually curb Iranian power in the region, zero. I think this was going to be kind of an olive branch offering to Trump that Putin could have pulled out of his pocket if he felt like he needed it.
I see. Interesting.
But it doesn't seem like he needed it.
Didn't need it to get anything else because everything else was already offered. I mean, that seems to me to be the big takeaway, is that there was a massive reset of the relationship, but with no change in behavior or return to status quo ante by the Russians. Well, Alina, this has been very revelatory, if not particularly optimistic, which is what happens to us a lot these days. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Shall we keep up some foreign relations? It's not a short list this week.
Sigh.
So I'm of the opinion that we need an actual trade section.
Yeah.
But we don't have a name for it yet. And we haven't fully come to, you know, intercommunal agreement between the three of us on this.
Correct. So,
but it's looming. I'm just giving a warning to everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I think we probably do need to, based on the length of my notes this week and what I'm actually going to cover. But what I will do is do a whirlwind tour with a couple of top line points here and then reference some things we might want to come back to in the upcoming weeks, and really dive in on some EU issues for this week, just given the summit. And
God, I hate that my life requires me to care about EU trade issues.
I know. And
I'm
this has actually really tested my decade old knowledge of monetary and trade policy. So bear with me as we try to do this. Okay, so quickly, as a reminder for folks, on Friday, July 20th, President Trump threatened to put tariffs on just about all of China's exports to America, and also attack the current policies in both China and Europe related to currency. It's not clear why Europe was on this list, because the euro is a much more complicated currency situation than the Chinese yuan.
Or renminbi, however you want to.
Right. And also broke a longstanding tradition on keeping U.S. monetary policy that is set by the Fed distinct from U.S. political policy and international policy, which Secretary Mnuchin had to walk back this weekend, sort of noting that Trump planned to keep it separate. All of that happened immediately before a bunch of finance ministers from a group of G20, that's the leading economies in the world, met to talk about global economic policy, with basically widespread condemnation of Trump's policy. One big issue that came up is the continued role of the U.S. in the WTO, and in particular, this national security carve-out that's been used by the U.S. to justify the current trade taxes, as I like to call the tariffs. Basically, this was put into the WTO trade agreement as a way to get the U.S. on board initially during the signing, and is critical, really, to be used in good faith. The Trump administration basically seems to be using it to justify more or less any tariff they want to impose, and that's creating a lot of lack of trust, but also a lot of concerns about other countries abusing that exemption.
And that's something that I think gets lost in the noise. Actually, random tariffs against random products or random countries are illegal amongst WTO members.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, by the way, is a system that we set up first under GATT and then under WTO.
Because we thought it was a good idea.
And in fact,
it is.
That leads to the point that most economists at this point are predicting a new recession. Look for it around in or around 2020, as the Fed has to increase rates to tamp down increasing prices. Those prices increase related to increased taxes on external goods, which both form the basis of consumer prices, but also intermediate goods. So the things that go into the things that you're buying.
I'm sorry, I blacked out there for a minute.
Well, the most important
thing is... Remind me
again
in 2020 whether we get a recession.
Correct. But also...
When I go to the mall at Christmas, what's going to happen?
Well, right. So that is the big question as to whether consumer prices are going to start jumping ahead of the 2018 election and how that might affect voting. Because we don't expect any job gains from these types of policies, given just what is impacted. But we do expect price increases. And actually, Forbes has a pretty good piece this week on sort of a behavioral economics take on this game of chicken and trade policy that the Trump administration is playing, and sort of how risk tolerance for cost, depending on how much you care about who's bearing the cost, affects your trade strategy. So sort of worth a read and worth also thinking about if we think this trade is a strategic decision. So just a couple of things to flag, and then I'm going to talk about the EU. One, China and the U.S. are basically in an escalating trade war, and there are a bunch of things China's doing to address for that, including its currency manipulation. Just as a reminder, that will basically reduce the relative price of Chinese goods to American goods, which will sort of undo the effect of these Trump tariffs.
Yeah, it's like down, I think, 8% since this trade talks have
Correct.
Started.
Which is,
but the dollar's also up against all currencies. I did my homework. Mm. Right. Also, let me say I'm very in favor of a strong dollar, and so
while
are
traveling.
All of the merchants in London who benefited from my largesse while I was overseas this week.
Right. You know who doesn't benefit? All those vendors in the U.S.
That's right.
Side note. So also ongoing is, of course, our fight with the EU. So just as a reminder, the U.S. and the EU have been talking about various taxes on first automobiles and then on steel and aluminum. About a third of the U.S. trade deficit with the EU is auto related. And this is actually really a key point. The EU charges a tariff on cars that are imported from the U.S., but a vast majority of those cars are actually exempt from the import tax because they use European parts. So if they use European parts, which we import and then assemble here with like American jobs and then export them back to Europe, they're exempt from the tariffs and create jobs. What happens now is they're not exempt from the tariffs in the EU, and those parts are not exempt from the tariffs coming into the US. So you've got a double whammy on European cars into Europe, which is sort of not ideal from a job standpoint, even if it is kind of increasing the actual price
global
of the
supply
good.
Markets, man. They'll get you.
So there's actually also a handy dandy list, which I will include in the show notes, of the long list of nearly $300 billion of stuff that the US exports to Europe that's going to be hit by the retaliatory tariffs, including, as we've discussed, delicious things like bourbon, which I suppose the Scots will be happy about, but everyone else might be sad about. A third just big bit of news is that the EU and Japan have cut a deal that basically
eliminates
more or less cuts or eliminates tariffs on nearly all goods. So this agreement covers about 600 million people, almost a third of the global economy. It includes complete removal of tariffs on a bunch of European exports, including things like cheese and wine. It also reduces trade barriers for the Japanese automakers and electronic firms, so firms that use things like metal products that are going to be subject to U.S. tariffs when trading into the EU. And the European Trade Commissioner, the EU Trade Commissioner, actually specifically linked this to Trump's policy. He was like, look, if America's going to close down their markets, we're going to be able to form our own sort of markets and they can either join us or not. Now, Mnuchin has been working overtime to try to spin this as a positive sign for the U.S. on how everyone's working to adjust their trade deals. It's kind of hard to see.
Well, if they agreed to it last year, this is sort of the formal signing, right? But it's definitely an interesting shift. And, you know, we could have been part of the TPP
Correct.
And had this deal or version of it with Japan
Right.
and a whole bunch of other East Asian countries.
Correct.
Instead, we are not. On the outside, burgeoning trade war with the EU, weird sanctions. Oh, by the way, ZTE was in the news this week. ZTE, we may remember from a few weeks ago, is a Chinese electronics firm that was busted for violating American sanctions against global sanctions against North Korea and Iran. There were then an effort to basically have punitive sanctions against them from the Congress, which has now walked away from that as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. So that punitive piece was removed.
This is my shocked face.
Yeah, I can tell. They'll still pay a big fine, but they will not basically get be blocked from all U.S. sales, though the U.S. government is not going to buy any ZTE equipment.
Good to know that we're not going to directly procure things that are spying on us.
Cool. Exactly.
In news of other companies that were being sanctioned, a Russian aluminum company, Rusal, was also seeking sanctions relief through the love and hugs method. So Rusal was sanctioned in April Basically, due to the majority share of the company being held by this Russian billionaire, Deripaska. I'm going to say that just right. So turns out this dude, Deripaska, is also the subject of the ongoing special counsel investigation into Russia's interference in the election and was sanctioned by the Treasury Department largely over his ties to organized crime and to Vladimir Putin. So in fairness, the sanctions are causing problems in the aluminum market because of the sort of interdependency of that market. But it's kind of awkward when the U.S. is basically imposing massive tariffs on our allies on this specific good, aluminum, to then be like, oh, but we really don't want companies to go out of business, especially this Russian company that seems to be very upset about it. So that's a sort of evolving story. We'll look to see whether the Treasury Department is able to provide sanctions relief and sort of how that's interpreted both by the Russians in the aftermath of a range of other things, but also the Europeans as we try to negotiate our current trade war.
Super. So somebody else is trying to negotiate some tricky trade issues, and that would be Theresa May's government in London. I was kind of disappointed that the government didn't collapse while I was there, which is a morbid sort of thought, but I thought it'd be really fun to watch that go down. Instead, she gave a speech in Northern Ireland last week that basically walked back the backstop, as it's been discussed. And we talked, I think, very early on the podcast, probably a year ago, about the way that Brexit negotiations and the Good Friday Accords intersect with regard to Northern Ireland, which is fairly complex, but it involves whether or not there is to be a physical border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, and the Republic of Ireland, which is the entire rest of the physical island of Ireland. So this had been sort of there had been an agreement between the Brits and the EU to say, yes, we'll figure this out. And by at minimum, there will not be a physical border. And that basically became politically untenable for Theresa May, like a number of other things, including her soft Brexit approach. And as I was talking to folks, while I was overseas, there's really no good option. I mean, she is between a rock and a hard place. And in some ways, it's a classic kind of Condorcet paradox, which is that there's no stable majority for any clear preference. So you can get people shifting between hard Brexit, complete leaving of any sort of single market, soft Brexit, where you maintain some of the restrictions, but probably remove the immigration access and some other things, and the Remainers, which are still like a non-trivial, you know, portion of both the MPs, members
like
of Parliament, and the voting public. Right. So they are. Interestingly, there's actually been kind of an uptick in some civil violence in Northern mm-hmm. Ireland these last couple of weeks, both in Derry and in some other places. So that could get talk about a conflict that I studied for a long time, but in like put in the resolved category.
So I was just going to say that there's the hard agreement part of reconciling Brexit with the Good Friday Agreement, but there's also the soft agreement part that basically being co-members of the European Union made the UK Republic of Ireland division on the island of Ireland less sort of like salient.
Right. It also removed a significant source of income for the IRA, who made a ton of money smuggling, and they would buy stuff in the Republic and sell it without tax in Ulster. And anyway, a random minor thing about how non-state actors often work. I can do arbitrage across borders, but it's a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real thing both for their revenue and for sort of creating public sentiment that is more sympathetic to that sort of behavior when there are these arbitrary divisions that feel more made by people who aren't relevant to the general populace.
And most of the Northern Ireland counties voted Remain, as did Scotland.
Right.
So anyway, a small thing as part of the broader EU Brexit discussions. Of course, President Trump did nothing to help this by completely savaging Theresa May upon arriving in London, including saying that there's no way that she's going to get a free trade agreement with the U.S., which was, again, kind of a hope and prayer.
The
whole point thing that they thought that they might be able to work out. So trade agreements, they're hard.
It is a special relationship.
It's very, very special.
And nobody's terribly good at them, apparently.
So one last thing in keeping up foreign relations, because it just is the topic that will not die, North Korea.
So we learned via a Washington Post story this week that President Trump is really quite unhappy with the fact that Secretary Pompeo and others are not making much progress with North Korea following his amazing headline-winning summit back in Singapore. Regardless of the President Trump's commitment that the remains of U.S. soldiers from the Korean War would be returned, that has made slow progress. There have been, despite the commitment from President Trump that there was no nuclear threat from North Korea. Actually, it appears that they have not destroyed the facilities that they committed to. They've actually been increasing nuclear activity in a number of fronts.
Again, shocked face.
And again, exactly. And then on top of that, have frankly just been unwilling to meet in any sort of productive form with Pompeo's team, or anyone really other than President Trump himself, with some negotiations being held up saying that we were only going to deal with letters between the senior leaders. And Trump in public has kind of blown this off, saying that I shall interpret broadly as if they denuclearize in 100 million years, then that will be fine in the in line with his agreement. But behind closed doors, he's been quite frustrated, saying what the hell is going on? I'm getting nothing but bad play from this summit that I thought was my big foreign policy win.
So his comments on there being no timeline, no speed test. I mean, am I on crazy pills or
isn't that the freaking point?
But also, isn't that strategic patience? How is that actually different from all previous policies? Exactly.
Right.
Because, of course, meanwhile, we've also lost a lot of leverage that we had built. And to be very fair to the administration, maximum pressure had built some leverage.
Right.
And had gotten the Chinese to act in a way that they had been unwilling to before.
This was actually one of few strategies that this Trump administration had come up with that was, I don't want to say working, but was at least functional in some way.
And now it's just squandered.
Yeah.
Because the Chinese are walking it back. The Russians are walking it back. They're see, you got a deal. Good to go. We don't need to brutally enforce these, border restrictions or other things. So now we've lost that leverage and we can't get people to meet with, Pompeo's getting just completely left at the altar, on these meetings, as our DOD folks when they try to do things
And we've sort of walked back our actual readiness in the region by canceling exercises and basically upsetting our closest allies in the region, which means even returning to pre-maximum pressure sort of middling containment strategy would be hard to do at this point.
But what's interesting to me is this basically plays in exactly to what John Bolton might desire out of the outcome of the Singapore summit, particularly as against the fact that we have Ambassador Harry Harris, who has just shown up. There's been some sort of delightful videos of him learning Korea over the last couple of weeks. I don't know if this has been actually formally confirmed, but the new Assistant Secretary for East Asian Affairs at the State Department is going to be a former general officer. So when you start to look around the table in terms of who are the main people in the room on North Korea, South Korea policy, they tend to be former military, very senior former military. And with those kinds of dynamics, you can see Bolton kind of building up a team that would be willing to consider something other than negotiation and maximum pressure, but actual military action.
So that would require Bolton to navigate a lot of White House mayhem.
And he, thus far, despite his mustache of the ultimate power, seems to kind of suck at it.
But that's because there's a lot of White House mayhem. Where do we decide to start on this conversation? Because I literally lost the plot on it because there were so many rivulets and sort of side stories and,
So I'll start on ISIS because it's sort of an interesting case study in how White House mayhem works right
now. It's so 2016.
Right, exactly. It's really about 2013 or so.
Exactly.
In the sense that we have, folks may remember that apparently we 100% defeated ISIS not long ago.
Again.
And since then, you have heard not a lot about U.S. activities both in Iraq and Syria from a military perspective. And my thesis on this that I think that DOD people are more or less willing to back up is that they don't want to talk about, DOD does not want to talk about anything that is going on in Syria or Iraq out of the fear that President Trump will force them to withdraw, as he threatened to do in Syria. And right now, if you ask anyone about the plan for withdrawal from Iraq, there's some kind of mumblings around we shut down that command, the warfighting command, in April, and for now we are just kind of hanging out here with a sustained presence. But the reason I'm harkening back to 2013 is that you're starting to see again from ISIS some of the lower level attacks that made them quite successful in terrifying, particularly in Iraq, the region, over the last couple of months or so, between assassinations of security forces, high level kidnappings, low level explosions and other kind of bombing attacks in the central Baghdad Kirkuk region, which are not necessarily trying to reclaim territory, but are absolutely exercising influence in the political dynamics there, which remain really shaky and frankly haven't changed a whole lot since the 2013-2014 time period. We haven't created an Iraqi security force or an Iraqi political arrangement that is super confident in being able to stand up to these forces. And frankly, in a lot of ways, the political arrangement has gotten significantly worse.
Well, the army is definitely in better shape than it was when Mosul fell.
Well, yes, but the army's better shape than it was. And then from a political perspective, deploying the army is in a better shape than it was. Right. But I guess what I would say is you're not going to see a lot of willingness for the United States to suddenly redeploy forces back into the region to undertake a bigger military campaign to go back and try to push against these sort of nascent ISIS fights that they're starting. And you're seeing this in parallel with in Syria. There has been a major Assad regime victory in southwest Syria, up against the Israeli border, mm-hmm. where they have taken back Dara, where you see a lot of refugees against the Israeli border. There's a lot going on that I think the United States would, under normal circumstances, be playing a more active role in. But right now is staying more behind the scenes because it really, really gets under Trump's skin that we are still have a major military presence in this region.
So the NSC, not super functional on Middle East policy.
Not functional. And not only that, you want anything that's bad news, you want to stay out of Trump's way. You want to stay out of the news. You don't want to be in his face, which is why Dan Coates' totally unrelated reactions this week were fascinating.
So what happened there?
Well, I believe that Dan Coates was at the Aspen National Security Conference, which talking to sort of, as many people say, national security elites, air quotes on elites, talking about a range of issues. And as he was there, the sort of Russia post-Helsinki summit situation was evolving. Coates had a very candid interview and discussion with the audience there, including when asked about Putin coming to visit the White House after a White House initial announcement, noting that that should be quite special.
Well, noting that he had not heard about it until Andrea Mitchell told him, which, you know, Dan Coates is the director for national intelligence. He's a fairly high ranking official in the administration, responsible for a good number of these issues.
Also unequivocally supported the intelligence community's assessment of Russian interference in the election, as we've discussed, was the source of the controversial statement by President Trump.
I mean, I can't wait for kind of like hashtag resistance to move from James Comey to Dan Coates as their savior here. That's going to be very interesting to watch. But it does sort of, there's no policy process being played out. This is like a totally atavistic, impulse-driven set of opportunities for folks. And so, I mean, it's so frustrating to watch DOD duck, dive, dodge, and everything. But their alternatives are not great.
Right. Their alternatives are like go out and make news in a number of ways that are going to get Trump's attention. I mean, Coates not only re-endorsed the 2016-2017 intelligence assessment, but said that Russia is continuing to try to intervene in our elections going forward, which again contradicts with what President Trump is himself saying in public. And also,
he told Putin to cut it out, don't you know?
Exactly. Well, but then also contradicts with another fascinating member of this administration, Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who went to Aspen and made her own news by...
Why did she?
Contradicting Coates in a number of fashions, like when pressed, kind of aligning with him, but saying that, like, you know, she has not seen evidence of interference with election infrastructure, which isn't a fascinating assertion of a word, that she does not think that the Russians are trying to push against the U.S. 2018 election in any way.
Which is disconcerting because DHS has, Department of Homeland Security, her department,
has a
responsibility.
Major role. Absolutely a major role.
Both for domestic cyber protections, mm-hmm. but also for other forms of election integrity. She did not cover herself in glory in any real sense.
But what's interesting to me in all of this White House mayhem that we're focusing on these back and forth between all these players is what has now been out of the news, despite the fact it has not been solved, is the crisis on the border of children being separated from their parents, the reunification of those children, and then what happens with those families when they're unified in any form. That has been completely overtaken by this he said, she said, Kirsten Nielsen, Dan Coats, President Trump on wither Russia policy. And in some ways, I've wondered, is that kind of the point? Like they're doing this back and forth on things that matter, but like matter less on an immediate term basis and have had far less attention on them on this actual crisis that we are seeing in U.S. immigration policy.
Well, I wonder if also some of it is, you know, Kristen Nielsen had some breaks with the Trump administration on the child separation policy itself. And as we all know, breaking with the President Trump is a sort of risky strategy for his cabinet secretary. So there's a sort of interesting thing to watch going forward on where Coates lands and how he talks about these things in the future, as well as what DHS actually does versus what it says related to child separation and election protections.
Can we talk about pop culture?
Yes, thank God. So I have pop culture.
You do? Oh my gosh.
Okay, guys, have you seen the show Supergirl?
No.
Okay, so one, some people watch The Flash. It's fine, but it's hardly as exciting as Supergirl. She's delightful. It's charming. It has, you know, action. And if you search for the lead actress and puppies, you will get a scene in which she is asked to answer really simple trivia questions about Supergirl while puppies just pour into the room she's in and she can't get distracted. And all the puppies have various Marvel comics, like superhero get-ups. And it's just several minutes of adorableness that is a complete antidote to this world. So watch Supergirl and watch that clip on YouTube.
Lauren, you've been reading books.
I have been reading books as my heal my soul effort this summer. The Bombshell summer reading list, if you've not gone through it, is actually a spectacular distraction.
I would expect nothing less.
The highest recommendations I can make are the one that Lauren Fish recommended, Life After Life by
Kate Atkinson.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Kind of set between World War I, World War II, some fascinating kind of magical realism elements to it. The other one I loved was Gentleman in Moscow.
So excellent. Good.
I have gotten through Corey Shockey's Beautiful Ruins, which is a wonderful kind of Hollywood Cinque Terre distraction if you need high distraction level. Sweet Tooth, if you're an Ian McEwan fan already, I would do it. If you're not, I would not. I was not already, and I probably should just have avoided at that point in time. And then my next one on the list is Asymmetry, what recommended by one Aaron Simpson.
And also, I think Fates and Furies is coming up.
Oh, yes. I just finished Fates and Furies.
Oh, so good.
Really, really good. I kind of want an explainer, or I just want to like go talk about it with people about like what
happened? We can do that. Open that next bottle of rosé and we can do that. I have lots of thoughts on Fates and Furies. I, meanwhile, have been watching airplane movies, of which there are lots.
Tell us of them.
I watched Molly's Game.
Yeah,
which
good.
I had heard of, and I'm sure you've also watched it on an airplane.
I sure have.
It's perfect for an airplane.
It's
an Aaron Sorkin movie about a high stakes poker game. Like if you ever watched in Ocean's 11, when Brad Pitt's character is like playing poker with these dumb like Hollywood people, that's what these games are.
Yep.
Except that it's a woman who ran these games, and eventually she gets busted. And this sort of, it was actually quite entertaining.
It was really well done.
But I also got to watch something that's not on American television yet. And like the whole point of going overseas is like to get stuff that you can't get here or to have experiences you can't have here. But it turns out globalization, while it's great, yada, 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 means that there's like Shake Shack and Skechers stores in London, which I find really irritating because I just want like actual like British things that, you know, I can't get, you know, net down the street.
Like Liberty Fudge.
Like Fudge from Liberty London. But what I did get to see was a preview of Innocence by Ordeal, which is a new Agatha Christie like multi-part series with Bill Nighy, with Matthew Good, who's going to be in your...
Yes, he's going to be in the Witcher
vampire.
Thing. He's going to be a vampire.
And who's also... Princess Margaret's husband,
indeed,
in The Crown, and he plays a completely brilliant, cruel, awful human being. So I was, of course, enraptured. It's really good. It's super moody. The decor and dresses are incredible, and there's massive changes from the book.
I love British miniseries. I'm so going to watch this.
So this will be on Amazon at some point, and we can all enjoy it. And I'm sure my mother has added it to her list already, but it will be great. So good. Our souls are fed full of meaningful pop culture while the world around us burns. And we have butter fudge to eat.
Thanks, Aaron.
You're welcome. And thanks, everybody else. We'll see you soon. Bye.